Hi there. Welcome to Piece of Work, the podcast. I'm Danielle Tantone. I'm a nurse, author, coach, and survivor. I love inspiring people to live their best life, reach for those big dreams, and find joy even in the pain. As I wrote my memoir over so many years, trying to make sense of a story where I was way too often the bad guy instead of the hero, I came to understand that we are all a piece of work, but we're also a work in progress. And even in our messiness, we are a work of art too, all at the very same time. In fact, we are all beautifully unique pieces of one masterpiece, waves in the same ocean. This podcast will explore the stories and struggles that make us human, the miracles that surround us, and all the ways we work to make sense of it all. Welcome to Piece of Work, the podcast. Today's episode is going to be a special excerpt from my book, Piece of Work, a Memoir. We are all a piece of work, a work in progress, and a work of art. I'm going to read you from the back cover, a little intro to the memoir. Piece of Work is the story of a spicy Jewish girl who tried to become a sweet Christian wife and failed miserably. Caught between expectations from two opposing worldviews, Danielle sought love like an addict chasing a drug. After years of tumbling through life searching for that missing piece, she finally found true love, forgiveness, and empathy within herself. With renewed faith, she faced breast cancer and became a nurse in the middle of a pandemic. She came to understand that her tumultuous life and complicated identity had left her with invaluable gifts, the ability to see both sides, the understanding of what it feels like to be broken, and the compassion to build up others. She discovered that we are all a piece of work, a work in progress, and a work of art, all at the same time. Enjoy the excerpt, and if you'd like to listen to the whole audiobook, it's available on Amazon and Audible. Piece of Work, a Memoir.
Chapter 2, A Refreshing Adventure, November 10th, 2003. Monday morning, back at home, every muscle in my body is stiff, and I can barely get off the couch to get a glass of water. But it's a good hurt, I tell myself. My little body did something amazing this weekend. As I lie on the couch, aching but happy, thoroughly enjoying my self-imposed recovery day, I watch TV, read a book, eat, sleep, and wait for James to email or call. I feel a giddy anticipation thinking about him, but he was so shy and reserved that I'm not sure he'll call. I'm thinking he probably is Mormon. The Mormon kids in high school choir were always the nice, wholesome, polite ones. My sister Courtney once had a Mormon boyfriend. But when it comes to marriage, well, Jewish moms want their daughters to marry nice Jewish boys. And I imagine a Mormon mom would want her son to marry a Mormon girl. And I don't want to waste any more time. I'm ready to start a family and begin a real adult life. I hear the garage open and Courtney's car pull in. She's a law student at ASU, and we've recently bought this cute little house together. It's been fun having my little sister as a roommate, and the house I found for us is perfect, in a small infill community of newer homes, right in the middle of South Scottsdale, where most homes were built in the 50s and 60s. It has vaulted ceilings, a kitchen island, and a nice open great room. We got it retiled before we moved in last month. It's a three-bedroom, so we decided it was fair that I get the master bedroom and Courtney get both tiny secondary bedrooms. We share the open den office, but I work from home, so I use it more than she does. Courtney is eternally at the law library, studying with friends. "How are you feeling?" she asks as she sets her keys and books on the counter. "Everything hurts, but I feel good," I say, whining just a little. I tell her about the cute, shy guy I met on the ride. When I finally see his name in my inbox, my heart leaps. "Hey, Danielle. James here from the MS-150. Sorry I didn't get the chance to say goodbye yesterday. I hope you recovered well. I think I have a cold coming on, but other than that, I feel okay. The sale I was telling you about at the shop is this Friday. We are located at the northeast corner of Alma School and Southern. 480-649-3394 is the number. Adventure Bicycle Company is the name. I haven't been able to get a hold of the girl I know who has a mountain bike your size. She night rides with us on Wednesday, so I'll ask her then. Later, James, Adventure Bicycle Company." "It doesn't really sound like he's all that interested in you," Courtney says matter-of-factly when I let her read it. "It's not at all flirty or anything." "Yeah, I guess not, but he's kind of shy. Maybe he's just not that flirty type," I say, defensively. I sense that he does like me, and that sending this email was a big deal for him. I read between the lines of his actual words to the meaning beneath. He wants to see me again. As I walk into the bike shop Friday afternoon, the hanging bells on the glass storefront door jingle to announce my arrival, and James looks up from the bike he's working on at the back of the shop. The floors are made of weathered hardwood boards, and my heels click as I walk toward him, past rows of bikes. I admire the shiny metal and pretty colors, the familiar smell of rubber and grease. James meets me at the glass counter that separates the sales floor from the service area. I look down at the various bike parts displayed in the case. "You look nice," he says, and I feel the sparks despite his reserve. "Thanks. I came from work, so not exactly dressed for a bike shop today," I say, smiling up at him. Way up. "I had a realtor home tour this morning, so I had to be professional and all that." The truth is, I took careful pains to appear classy and professional, but cute and a little sexy at the same time, without trying too hard. I settled on a pair of navy capris and a fitted, slightly sheer white button-down, and I decided to blow my longish curly hair straight, which I rarely do. I wanted him to see that I clean up nicely. James doesn't own the shop, but he explained to me during the ride that he works alongside the owner, Greg, managing it and practically running things. He's known as a great bike mechanic, and cyclists from all over town come to have him fix their bikes. Greg trusts him implicitly, and despite his shyness, I can tell James is also a great bike salesman, because he has an honest and gentle way about him, knows his product, and listens well. People always think that being good at sales is all about the talking, but I've found that people who know how to listen rather than talk all the time can connect with their customers and have far more success in sales. James does this naturally. It's something I'm still working on. I tend to talk more than I listen. He's invited me to a special sale they're having today for their regular customers, and I've stopped by for some bike shorts and socks, but mostly to see James and talk more about the mountain bike ride he suggested for this Sunday. He's an expert mountain biker, just one step down from professional. I've never tried riding off-road, and I'm excited for my first time to be with him. He shows me the cycling gear, and I pick out a pair of women's shorts from among the two or three choices. It's obvious this shop caters more to men than women. "Can you show me some of the mountain bikes?" I ask. I don't know anything about mountain biking, but I've always wanted to learn, just never had someone to teach me. I briefly wish I had bought a mountain bike in college instead of a road bike. But then I guess I wouldn't have met James on the MS-150 road ride. Everything happens for a reason. "I'll teach you," James offers shyly. "That would be awesome. Hope you're not just saying that. It would require lots of time together, I would think," I flirt. "I can handle that," he says with a half smile. This whole exchange feels old-fashioned and simple, G-rated and sweet compared to my recent interactions with guys. James is a different breed. I feel like I'm being taken back into another time, and I absolutely love it. Later that evening, after attending a Shabbat dinner for local Jewish singles, I decide to call James at the shop, under the pretext that I need another pair of shorts, which isn't untrue. Old-fashioned or not, I can tell that if I want anything to happen here, I'm going to have to push things along just a bit. Greg answers and calls James to the phone. "Your girlfriend's on the phone, Jimmy." I grin into the phone, thrilled at this tiny confirmation that he does like me, and thinking again what a departure this is from my previous experience of dating, which usually involved hooking up after some drinks and hoping it would turn into something more. I ask James to charge a second pair of shorts to my credit card and tell him I'll get them from him next time I see him, thus ensuring there will be a next time soon. "By the way, what are you guys doing after the sale tonight?" I ask, thinking maybe they're going out for drinks as a group. "Nothing that I know of," he says. "Oh, well, do you want to go grab a drink or something then? I was out with some friends earlier, but I'm not tired," I say, not specifically mentioning that it was a Jewish thing. It's not that I'm ashamed of my Judaism. I'm just not ready to explain it yet. "Sure, that would be great," he says. He calls me back when he gets off work about 20 minutes later, and we decide he should just come over to my place. That night, we talk a lot, flirt a little, drink one beer each, and get to know each other. I learn that he's not Mormon, but Christian. And I don't mean Christian as in celebrates Christmas and Easter and goes to church occasionally. He's one of those people who read and study the Bible, applying it to every aspect of life. I realize he probably thinks I'm going to hell because I don't believe in Jesus. He doesn't specifically say so, but I knew some born-again Christians in high school, and that's what they told me. They seemed unaware that the fear of hell was a poor sales pitch since I didn't believe in a literal hell any more than I believed in Jesus. I've always believed in God, talked to him in my head, bounced things off him. I guess you'd call it praying, though Jewish prayer is generally more formal. In synagogue, we recite specific phrases in Hebrew, excerpts from the Psalms or verses from the Torah, during a formal service, led by a rabbi, followed by a poetic translation into English en masse. I love the haunting Hebrew melodies that pepper our prayer services. the beauty and symbolism of God's sacred Torah scroll and the ark that holds it. But along with the formal prayers, we're encouraged to pray silently too. I speak freely to God about anything and everything. I ask him about stuff, thank him for things. I feel like God is a part of me. I know he hears my thoughts, knows my intentions, and loves me just the way I am. God is everywhere and everything. I am made in his image. I believe people are basically good. We don't need a savior or an intercessor. There's one God, and I already know him. Judaism teaches that we are God's chosen people. I believe this, even though I can't quite wrap my brain around why God needs to choose favorites. But I'm content with knowing that there are some things I won't fully understand until I see God face to face. And I can't help but wonder if perhaps all the world's religions are more similar than different. Maybe we're even worshiping the same God and don't even know it. In my earliest memory of grappling with the concept of God in an intellectual way, I'm looking up at the arched stained glass window above the slump block western wall of the main sanctuary of Temple Solel in second grade religious school. Ashlosh la devarim, ashlosh la devarim, ashlosh la devarim, haolam omed. We sing, the world stands on three things, Torah, Avodah, and Gemilut Hasadim, learning, ritual practices, and acts of loving kindness. Reform Judaism is the most modern of the three branches of Judaism, emphasizing the evolving nature of the faith, focusing on progressive values, ethics, human reason, and intellect, with less stress on ritual observance and traditional Jewish law. I was raised in a community of inclusiveness and acceptance, taught to participate in tikkun olam, repairing the world, making it a better place, healing, helping, caring for the marginalized. But the main tenet of Judaism, whether you are Reform, Conservative, or Orthodox, is that there is one God, period. End of story. We chant it in the most sacred and simple Jewish prayer, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. And the Ve'ahavta, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. But I've always been curious about Jesus. Who was he really? And why do so many people think he was God's son? What's the deal with the Trinity, three in one? In high school choir, I loved singing those beautiful Christmas carols, even the ones that mentioned Jesus. I longed to be part of all that was Christmas instead of feeling like an awkward outsider. But believing in Jesus, or even thinking about him, is simply unacceptable for Jews, and he is inaccessible to us. To believe in Jesus would be blasphemous. Jews for Jesus is like a conflict of interest, a type of cult we learned about in high school religious studies. You can't be a Jew and be for Jesus. If you're for Jesus, you're a Christian, not a Jew. And at the same time, what I believe isn't really what makes me Jewish. Judaism is funny that way. It's both a religion and a heritage. I'm Jewish because my mother is. Jewish lineage follows the mother's line. It's a birthright, not something someone can take away from me. Once a Jew, always a Jew. Even if I were to convert to Christianity, I'd still be a Jew by lineage. And if the Nazis were in power today, I'd be marched into that concentration camp right alongside my parents, my sister, and all my second and third cousins, regardless of what I told them I believed. I have Jewish blood coursing through my veins because both my parents are Jewish. My dad is not the least bit religious, but he's still Jewish. His family is French and spent generations in Alexandria, Egypt, so they followed the Sephardic traditions of Judaism, a whole different flavor from my mom's Ashkenazi Jewishness most common in the U.S. My first husband, Ian, didn't believe in God, but we still celebrated Christmas. I even cut down my first live tree with him in upstate New York and then decorated it in our Manhattan apartment. According to him, I was too religious. But the truth is, I've always been more spiritual than religious. Seeking truth, trying to understand God and people, never simply following the rules and reciting prayers and rituals by rote. In my mind, religious is doing things the way they're supposed to be done, without asking why. It's a lot of shoulds and shouldn'ts. There are religious Jews, Christians, Catholics, Mormons, Muslims, even atheists. That's not me. But I've always been interested in religion, faith, humanity, and understanding the divine power that to me is undeniable on this earth and in each of us. I guess that's one reason my first marriage didn't last long. How could I be with someone who doesn't even believe there's a God when I see evidence of his amazing handiwork everywhere I look? In a baby's smile, a patch of grass, a bird's song, the kindness of people, the tiny miracles of everyday life. As soon as James and I start talking about past relationships, I'm struck with the absolute certainty that this handsome 26-year-old 6'4 man is a virgin. I make sure he understands that I've been married and divorced already, and that even if I hadn't, I never even considered saving sex for marriage. I tell him a little bit about Ian, and he reveals that he's recently broken up with a girl named Janie, the first girlfriend he'd had since high school, when he decided to swear off dating in favor of mountain biking. "Did you have sex with Janie?" I ask, already knowing the answer. "No." "Have you ever had sex?" "No." "Are you waiting for marriage?" I ask, knowing he is. "Yes," James says, breathing a sigh of relief and looking at me with a bewildered expression, his eyes asking, "How on earth could you have guessed that?" I know, because this conversation is like a deja vu of another conversation 10 years ago with Lewis, a Christian guy I dated briefly in college. It's because of Lewis that I even know this is still a thing people do, saving themselves for marriage in the name of Jesus. I met Lewis on an Outdoor Adventures rock climbing trip I was co-leading. He was an engineering student. I was a journalism major with a French minor who had, up until recently, believed engineers were the drivers of trains. Of course, I knew there must be more to it, since there was a large, prominent stone building on campus with the name Engineering carved into the top. But I didn't quite understand what engineers did. After hours of subtle flirting while we practiced rock climbing on Mount Lemmon, I had convinced Lewis that I owed him an ice cream. Sitting on the curb outside the brand new Cold Stone Creamery, where they hand-mixed your ice cream creation on a marble slab, Lewis stretched out his sleek, shaved legs. He was a cyclist on our college team, and I was thinking he must be quite the ladies' man with those bedroom eyes and that rock-hard cyclist body. I imagined he had slept with many girls. Not that I was promiscuous or anything. I had only had sex a few times, but I usually assumed I was less experienced than most people around me, not more. "Do you have a girlfriend?" I asked. "Nah, I haven't really met anyone I like," Lewis answered, smiling at me. "Well, there must be lots of girls you mess around with, though." "You mean like sex? I don't do that," he said softly. "You don't?" I asked, incredulous. "What do you mean?" "I'm waiting until I get married." "What? You can't be serious. But you're gorgeous. You could get any girl you want. Why would you want to wait until you get married? For all we know, we may be like 30 before we get married." "Well, I'm a Christian, and I believe in the Bible, and I try to live my life as Jesus did," Lewis said, absolutely serious. "And did Jesus actually say not to have sex until you're married?" "Yeah, you know that commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery," he said with a smile, giving my arm a gentle punch. He had a slight southern drawl that was very sexy. How ironic that the sexiest guy I had ever gone out with wasn't even looking for sex. "Adultery is having sex with someone other than who you're married to, or someone who's married to someone else," I retorted. "If neither of you was even married in the first place, you can't really commit adultery. And anyway, didn't Jesus live thousands of years after the Ten Commandments were delivered to the Jewish people?" "Well, whatever," he said, a little flustered. "Then it's fornication. All I know is I'm saving myself for my future wife, just as she will do for me." So there we had it. I knew where that relationship was going. Nowhere. I wonder if it will be like that with James. If he too will push me away because I'm not Christian. Despite our religious differences, Lewis and I dated for several months. I was pretty sure even then that if Jesus didn't want him having sex with someone who wasn't his wife, then he also wouldn't want him not having sex but being with her the way we were. I still blush when I think of all the things he taught me about the male body. But they weren't my rules to follow, and we had a great time together. He came home with me for Thanksgiving and met my parents and everything. But even though I imagined a future with him, he made it clear he didn't see one with me. He never tried to convert me or even really wanted to talk much about what he believed. He kept it to himself. I guess he thought I was a hopeless case. There was no way I was becoming a Christian, so he might as well have a little fun with me. I wasn't marriage material. Lewis was out of my reach. We broke up when I headed to Paris to study abroad the spring of my junior year, and I don't think the French had ever considered reserving sex for marriage. Half the time, they didn't even bother with marriage, but simply lived together and had kids without that religious and legal permission slip. But now I realize that Lewis did plant some seeds all those years ago. He introduced me to the crazy notion that even in this modern age, one could and maybe should save sex for marriage. I started asking questions about Jesus and his relationship to Judaism, bought a few books on the subject, and fell in love with the Christian pop music he listened to. I still have the cassette tape of Michael W. Smith songs he recorded for me. And sitting here with James now, I can't help but wonder if there isn't some reason I had that experience with Lewis back then. Was it preparing me for something? Is God trying to tell me something? I have always believed that everything happens for a reason. "I think we should go out to dinner tonight," I announce as James is getting ready to leave. "I agree," he says with a shy smile. "Do you like Mexican? My sister Courtney told me about a great little place just up the street." "Sounds perfect. I'll pick you up at 7. Despite our vastly different backgrounds, I wonder if James and I have a future together, or if he will be just out of reach like Lewis was.